So again, I wish you all a happy new year. Hope it's getting started in the right way. Not sure what the right way is, but. So tonight, I want to speak about the Sangha, That's all of us together. That's literally the word means gathering in Pali. But it's a gathering around, it's not just a gathering of like minds, although that certainly is the case, but there's also a way that we gather around together for a particular purpose, for a particular intention. And it's very unique in that sense. It's the intention that we gather around is not just to reinforce each other's belief system, which many religious organizations do. They try to bring in more people to confirm their own sense of belief. The more people you have believing like yourself, the more you can rest in the belief you have. It's a way of distancing yourself from the doubt that a belief system gives you. So the Sangha in this case is not around a belief system at all. Although for many people it starts out that way. It starts out as something that you've heard, it sounds right. But I could probably convince those of you who haven't done much practice that many of the other religious traditions sound right. So it's not about sounding right in itself. It's around something else. It's around seeing directly, knowing what is true. Very powerful. When you begin to sense that the truth has a different impact upon you, different resonance with you, then that resonance is no longer something that is arguable. It's not like you have to proselytize. You don't have to convert. There's no missionaries. It's everyone is welcome to come and see. Ae pasika openaiko. Everyone, please come. But it doesn't have a belief structure as such, which is something that's very delightful and very rare. Because what we're after is to see what is true. And that is the compelling nature of what the Sangha gathers around. Let's see what is true. And it's very helpful to have people with you, because the truth is not an easily digestible item, if you haven't noticed. I mean, there's our personal truths. Those are very difficult. And then there are the generic truths, and those are equally as difficult. There's no easy truth to be, because every time we look at something, we have protected ourselves from is seeing that very object, that very truth. And we have elaborate defense mechanisms to keep ourselves very contained within the truths that we assert, our opinionation, our belief structure. And as we are willing to step out of that belief structure and actually see what is true, not what I have always said to myself I thought was true, or not what I've been told that was true, but to actually see for ourselves what is true, then that blows a big hole in virtually everything. And it goes straight into the heart, a penetrating sense of wonder. And so this sense of wanting to come together as a group and enjoy the company of others who are also wanting to see what is true. There aren't very many of us in this world, let alone this country or this community, that really has that as its intention. And because of that, something beautiful can happen when we gather. And I'm going to talk about that in many different aspects tonight. But that sense of providing a container where you can come and see for yourself. And the practice is just meant to do that. The practice is meant, that's all meditation is a way, is a technique to pierce all of our opinions and all of our expectations and all of the judgments we have and all of the knowledge base that we have gained over our lifetime, see something free of all of that accumulated storehouse that we have learned to live with and to project onto what is there, to see it free of all of that, to see what life is in its clarity, in its original face, you might say. And that is a beautiful way that we all contain each other's arrival, because it's a container, it's a safe container that we provide one another. In some eras, saying what is true, you know, could be a could lead to your death, literally. So we're in an era now of the West in which it's okay to be able to explore in this fashion, and that's rare as well. So the Sangha is a container for each of us to arrive and explore together. And some of us, it's a little bit, you know, some of us are just getting going on this thing. So other people have been doing this for decades. And yet the whole container is, doesn't matter how long one has done it. It's that we're doing it. And so there's a lot of tolerance, or there should be, for bringing people along and encouraging their practice forth. And so the Sangha offers that encouragement as well. Now, when we think of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, the three refuges, generally, the Buddha and the Dharma, the Dhamma, they come pretty easily from the East to the West. It's a pretty easy transition to bring the Buddhism into the West and with the Dharma. You know, it's a little bit of adjustment from whatever religions or traditions we might have come from, but it makes sense to us, and we're not asked to believe much, and we like the fact that we're not being converted to something. So those two factors, those two refuges, come pretty easily, are transplanted pretty easy from the East to the West. The third refuge, the Sangha, isn't so well, because it requires our energy to build upon it. The Buddha and the Dharma, they come pretty much as they have been, and the truth hasn't changed in 2,500 years. So it has, it's a pretty clear direction that's laid out in Buddhism. But the Sangha seems like a third wheel. What do I need it for? You know, we try to bring our self-reliance and our independence and our, you know, I can do this on my own sort of way into Buddhism. And it doesn't work very long in that way. We don't go very far. We need each other. And so this sense of willful independence that the West holds in high value is both has a value to the Dharma. It also has a limitation. The value, of course, is that sense of self-reliance is an important attribute to a Dharma practitioner. You shouldn't just expect others to be able to tell you what is true. You have to see for yourself. So there is a self-reliant component to Dharma practice. But this sense of independence, of kind of, you know, I can do it on my own, there's too much egoic maneuvering in that. There's too much, any time you have that sort of exaggerated statement in yourself. Now, I'm not going to sit with crowds. I can do this on my own. You really feel as if there's a compensation activity going on there. What's being compensated for in the West, I think, is that a strong sense of self-doubt we all have. Most people in the West have a very strong sense of doubt, whether they can do it or not. And to counteract that doubt, they assert their independence to try to cover that doubt over. So we have to be aware that this gem, this sense of Sangha, is really an equal part of the unfolding of it all. And even though we may be introverted as opposed to extroverted, because Dharma practice brings in a lot of people who love the quiet, there's nothing wrong with that. Still, we have to see the value in coming together from time to time. See the value in communication and living side by side with each other, because there's so much information that's imparted in relationship about us internally that I'll get to in just a minute. So the Sangha has to be built by each one of our energy. We have to infuse energy into the Sangha. It's not a passive activity, and I've said this many times. You just don't come and listen to a talk and go away, or you come once a year for your protection cord. But it's something that is an ongoing expression of our life, and we have to assert the energy needed to keep it going. The momentum of it is really each of our responsibility. And so this sense of building a Sangha, you know, it's not very well understood in the West what the value of Sangha. I was attending a teacher's meeting a few years ago, and they, as a presentation in the teacher's meeting, they had Joseph Goldstein, who gave a little summation of the value of retreating and how retreating, the process of retreating unfolds to offer a greater freedom. And he did an excellent job, as you might suppose. And then we had Ajahn Suchito, a monk of some 30 or more years, give an outline of the monastic approach, how the monastic approach, the evolution of a monk who takes robes and one who stays for the course of decades. But what was missing was a description of the lay process. And they didn't have that presented, because as the Dharma is being unfolded in the West, there's value on retreating, there's value to the monastics, although most people don't take that particular route, but there's a diminishment of the understanding of what Sangha, everyday lay life, and the purpose and intentionality and benefits of lay life are. And there aren't very many people that really thoroughly understand that. Because where this practice came from 40 years ago was from, it was an evolution of the monastic tradition that became our residential silent retreats. That was the evolution of the monastic tradition. Without the monastics was the quiet silent retreat. And so it really hasn't been explored sufficiently. The lay life hasn't been explored sufficiently to see the fruits and values of what coming together periodically as a Sangha, the benefits of that really are. And it saddens me, really, because the Buddha said very clearly, he said, he was asked whether his lay followers awakened. You know, he says, many of them have awakened, not just a few. Many of them have awakened. These are not monastics. And I'm sure they weren't doing silent retreats back then, or they were like you and I, who were living their lives fully. And yet many people had awakened during the Buddhist time, lay people. And so I think it's been a lost tradition. And I think we are now recovering it as we are finding ourselves coming back into the culture, the city, and beginning to explore the undercurrents of our life and begin to see what is true about that life in the full monte of our living behavior. And it's exciting to me because I've always had that disposition. There are others I know, like Narayan in Boston, and et cetera, who are equally have the equal intention of first of all, just saying, you know, this is it. This is where we are. This is where we're landing here. This isn't a secondary practice. If we had it together, we wouldn't all be monastics. If you had it together, you wouldn't be on 3-month retreats. If you had it together, you would be using what's right in front of you right now, all your entire array of life, for the purpose of your own transformation. And that can be done. And these meetings from time to time intone that intentionality and that conviction. And not very many of us hold that. We go out, get lost in our job, our work, our relationships. We come back together and we're reminded from time to time that that's a possibility. And it's always a possibility. That's what meeting in a group does for us. It asserts, first and foremost, that intentionality and that possibility for us. That's what we do. That's why we're meeting here. We're not, this isn't some educational process to get you converted to Buddhism. In fact, don't become a Buddhist. It's easier if you don't. Don't become anything. Then you'll really know what life is about. So this sense of coming together with that intentionality, of using our life and the dynamics that are in front of us for the deepest penetration of insight and wisdom to understand what is true. And I want to bring up something tonight because I hear it every once in a while from political activists or social activists. They often say, you know, they think they don't meditate, or some of them refuse to meditate because they think the practice is selfish. They think it's a selfish undertaking. And I'd just like to say a couple of words to that. So I'd like to ask you whether taking a shower is selfish, or eating your food in the evening and is selfish. Obviously it's not, but it's the same thing. Unless we know what we're seeing, everything that we do on an outward display, every action that we take, is really just more of the same. This is about basically changing our disposition, the way that we see life, our understanding of what life really is. It's access, it's perception. And that allows us to engage very differently within the disturbances that are around and the difficulties that our lives are filled with, than simply going out and acting first and then letting those actions compound themselves into other reactions, and on it goes. Now, I'm not suggesting that all of us have to be fully awake before we get involved with social action or political action, but that we should be doing it in combination with one another, that we should be looking at the way we're relating to our social action and the separation that we invite within that perception of them and us as part of the very way that we're claiming to change in our inward life too, and really questioning whether there is a them to us. And as we begin to adjust and see that that's a perceptual distortion, the sense of you and me is really the way the mind has been conditioned to see the world. It's not basically the truth of life. And that begins to dawn on us through our practice. Then our social actions will follow in suit with the inclusiveness of the way we see, and not the separation that we would, which is really opinionation and conflict. And I mean, it's all of what it is. It's, the world has been based on that for some 2 million years of our history. So we're asking for this change to be a component, an accompaniment of whatever actions we're involved in, whatever sense of priorities that we have. We bring the evolution of our inward life along with whatever actions we're taking. You know, it's interesting because when I first started teaching, not teaching, but practicing over 40 years ago, you know, it was really about me and the problems I was having, as most of us start practicing. The tensions I was having, I wanted a different way of being in life. I wanted to be less conflicted. And so it was really a self-centered approach to practice, which I think most of us get started with that particular way of that idea about change, self-change. But as it grows on you, as you evolve and allow your perceptions to change, you realize, you know, that you start living outside of the sense of me and you, of separation, of distance, of individuation. And there's a sense of everyone being here at the same time. That this isn't about me changing and you being left behind. It's about all of us moving together, moving in the spirit of that change. The consciousness of the human species, the consciousness of the planet, is what needs to be uplifted. The individuals are in varying places within that conscious uplift. But we're not. It's not about me getting out of here and leaving everybody behind. It's the whole thing, everything. And that's the true bodhisattva vow, that we're all in this together. We are all in this together. We're all in this together. It can't be. You can't think of it in any other way when you start perceiving in that direction. And so you don't think any longer about, you know, how much longer do I have before I can be fully awake, and then I don't ever have to. I don't know the ways that some people think about their practice. Because all of our wakefulness depends upon each other. It depends upon the storekeepers and the workshop owners and the neighbors and the children, all of that. The whole of the consciousness has to be uplifted. And we meet as a confirmation of that point. All of us meet here together, not independently of one another, but to bring the whole thing along. And it may take a long time, I don't know. But I do know, I sense, even in the few decades I've been doing this, I sense the evolution moving forward. And that's within one lifetime. That's within a few decades. So it is having its impact, and of course, whenever you uplift and increase the consciousness of the planet, you have those pockets of resistance that explode upon the scene in terms of ideology, and you see that happening worldwide. You see that happening very strongly in the States here. And it's a counter-reaction to the increase of consciousness. It's a protective defense mechanism from what? Fear, really. The fear of having to live outside of the entrapped way I've always known life to be. And so in this particular tradition, but it isn't this particular tradition, really, because it really has to do with the correct way of seeing. The correct way of seeing isn't a belief, it's an inclusive way of seeing. When we're opinionated, that's exclusive. It's just me and my thoughts against and pitted against you and your thoughts. When we're inclusive, the opinions don't even matter. And so it involves both the one and the many. Yes, I have to be self-reliant, I have to take care of my own inward processes, I have to show up and see what is there that I'm denying. I have to look and be willing to look at areas of darkness in myself that I have long neglected. And it's about the many. It's about all of us coming together and increasing our own well-being as a unit across spectrum, across individuals, and infesting within the greater sense of that consciousness arising. And that confirms the heart. And if there's ever a question of selfishness, well, may I say, just look at your heart and see if your heart has grown. Because if your heart has been touched, you aren't being more selfish, you're being less selfish. Your heart warms, if your heart warms more, if your heart touches pain with a greater sensitivity, if you're available in ways that you weren't, that's because you have grown into your heart out of selfishness. People look, don't understand what it means to grow out of one's egoic center. This is what it means. It means that you'll start feeling your heart with greater compulsion, with greater sensitivity, with greater understanding. You know, I, as an early Christian in my youth, I remember the Christian saying, you know, what Christ said, when two or more are gathered in my name. And I always thought, no, what, why two? Why can't it just be one? What's the two about? See, that was my, I can do this on my own, just leave me alone. And then I read a Buddha quote that he said, find a friend to go with you who is steady, careful, and mature, and together you can overcome all hardships with mindfulness and joy. So I see, right? Now it's beginning to make sense here. Because what we begin to realize is you can't do it by yourself. Can't do it by yourself. None of us can do it by ourselves. You see, you need that feedback. You need that buffer. You need that mirror back to yourself. How will you know? Have you ever? When I was living alone for a number of years, I was just coming out of Asia, where I'd lived alone for a number of years, and I just didn't feel like I was getting the information back about myself. I couldn't see it objectively because it was subjectively me, and I couldn't see my conditioning in relief to myself. And but I got in relationship, and that shows you very quickly what you carry, doesn't it? You see, most of us create a problem with the relationship from those areas that begin to arise. But those, for people like you and I, or who are using our self-knowledge, relationship as self-knowledge, you begin to take those moments of tension and conflict. And every moment of tension and conflict has a deep lesson for us to learn if we know how to interpret it really. And so it begins to show us more deeply where it is that we are begrudging the change that's necessary in this moment, where we're holding on and not releasing ourselves to the flexibility and flow and movement of life. And that can only happen with two or more people. And so it's a very important understanding to have. The other important component of that is that the mind doesn't exist alone. It's always in relationship. And I don't mean with someone, but with something. Always. When there is a observer, there is something observed. There's always a relationship to the mind. It cannot exist independently. You're never in total isolation because you're always carrying a relationship with you mentally. And to realize then that because it has to be in relationship, it might as well be a useful one in which I am using others for my own growth and others are using me for theirs. And let's just put this need for growth into that relationship component that the mind intrinsically holds. Find a friend to go with you who's steady, careful, and mature. It's really a beautiful encouragement towards friendship, you know, towards banter, towards just being with together, and they're good people. I mean, people aren't, for the most part, thieves aren't drawn to this practice. Why is that? Because we're becoming more conscious, and when you become more conscious, you notice you're a thief. Say, oh my God. And that, the more consciousness we bear upon our indiscretions, the more we can't live with our indiscretions. And so that very slowly changes all of us over time, so that we're more open, you know, and you say, okay, you know, this, wow. And now you have good people who have crossed that particular threshold themselves and aren't interested in hurting others, which is one of the first real insights that people have, or changes that this practice really encourages. Doesn't just encourage it, the transfer, one, the first transformation is that, you know, I don't want to hurt anybody anymore. Do you want to hurt anybody? Why would you want to hurt anybody anymore? Doesn't make sense to hurt anybody. And then that, when that really gets deeply into you, then you have a room full of good people who aren't interested in keeping you in your place. In fact, just the opposite. We want and encourage your buoyancy, your uplift, your insight, your sincerity, because it brings me up with it. I float up with you, you see? When I'm passionate, which is one of the reasons I don't tuck in my passion, people say, well, you get a little, I'm sorry, but this is the, because I think it's contagious, because it's true, it's a true life energy. Let's look at this thing together. That's the passion. And so when we're in a group of people in which that is a common experience of people seeing, there's nothing that brings passion and excitement to your life than seeing what's true. That's what's so amazing, is that you're just seeing life in its bare, raw form, and it's exciting what you see. It invigorates, it really does. You can be extraordinarily joyful. In fact, there's no more joyful life than a life lived in the Dharma. So let me just go through a few points, if I could, about the value of other values of the Sangha. But the first one I want to talk about is accentuating the fact that we're all waking up together. And, you know, not everybody is on the same, at the same speed and is encouraged or is effortful in their attempt or even their intention to wake up. But that's what we're all doing here. And to actually say, okay, you know what? I don't know what I was doing here before tonight, but yeah, waking up sounds like something I'd like to do. Waking up simply means being more aware. Waking up. So that where we're asleep, where we refuse to pay attention, we're waking up beyond that refusal, beyond that denial. That's all. So you're already doing, we are already doing whatever the illicit behavior is, and we're just waking up to the fact of what we're already doing. It shouldn't hurt, because we're already doing it. Somehow it seems to. But for all of us to say, okay, yeah, you know, I want to do that. Let me set that intention for ourselves. I think when we get on that common conveyor belt, where we all realize that this is for everyone's good, including mine, and the more wakeful I am, the more it imparts that wakefulness to others. You can feel it when you're in a room with somebody who's awake. It uplifts. You want to be with that awake too, at least I always did. And that's what it does. It generates a kind of contagious feeling of, oh yeah, this is really something I want to be a part of. And that's what coming together as a group offers. Commitment to the inward work and to the inquiry, questioning. You know, the question, like, what is this? That's a question, that's a wake-up question. What is going on here? Say that to yourself from time to time when you find yourself in a repetitive habit, conditioning. What's going on here? Why do I keep doing this? Say it with some urgency. Shake yourself awake. It's like, what's going on here? What view am I operating from? A view of selfishness, of separation? That's not going to get us very far. That's the view we live with. It's not going to get, well, how about just relaxing here and feeling more inclusive, allowing some of the contraction in me to relax and just start perceiving now from a different vantage point. And very quickly, you can sense a greater sense of connectedness, a greater sense of inclusivity. And that only comes, the effect of that upon you is one of relief, unburdening. The load is off. And yet we continue to carry a burden with us because we would rather be burdensomely ourselves than see the truth of our union, of our inclusiveness. So there's a lot that we have to really face up to as we move towards wakefulness. And each other, I mean, we're all in this together. And as we sit together in small groups or whatever our discussions are, we can start talking about that. You know, we say, wow, you know, this is hard. This is what happens to me. And that's the value of sharing, is that you see whatever you think, however far you think you're behind, you're not far at all. Even the teachers, if they're human, share with you their limitations. The second challenge of the Sangha is a challenge to our complacency. Now, I find that to be helpful because we get stuck in patterns. We get stuck in repetitive ways that we operate in life. And a good friend, can suggest things gently. You know, you do this every time, but, you know, have you, I don't know how to put it so that one can hear, because it's not very easy to hear, I grant that. But the fact is that to have somebody give feedback is a very valuable resource. We don't like it. We want to hear that we're perfect, but none of us think we really are. And for someone to touch us lightly on the, not in a condemning kind of way, not in a judgmental way, but just say, let's just look at this thing, because I do it the same, and maybe together we can explore what's going on here with a little more depth and understanding. It can be very helpful, really. And the other encouragement that the Sangha can offer is one that lies at the heart of what Buddhism is and where our growth lies, and that is to move towards the difficult. We're not given to or prone to that direction at all. And so from time to time, as we come back and rehearse what it is to means to have a Dharma life, to live a Dharma life, you begin to think, oh yeah, this, too. Oh, I forgot about that point. Yeah, of course, right. Move towards the reaction, not away from it. And that just redirects us time and time again. And you have to hear it 10,000 times before it really sinks in us sufficiently so that you can walk out of here without having someone else remind you about it. To move towards the difficult. It's not an easy pattern to extinguish, moving towards the pleasant only. And yet that's what the Dharma does. And a third beautiful attribute of the Sangha is its sense of safety. There probably, I can't think of a safer group of people. This is, you know, you can bring up just about anything within reason and have it explored and without a lot of judgment coming at you from different directions. The deepest crisis you have can be explored. And it's a beautiful sense of being held very differently than the general population. You're not being criticized for having a problem. Let's explore this together, is the movement of the Sangha. And that sense of questioning rather than conforming. Let me look at what's going on here rather than just following suit. Because we're not a group of people that tries to establish a one set of behavior, a conforming behavior for us all. We're independent in that way. We each have the resonance of where we need to go. But we need to go. We need to move towards it rather than just be complacent within our conditioning and just live there with it on and on for decades. There was a, I went to school in the University of North Carolina, and at the North Carolina motto is Esse Quam Videri, which means to be rather than to seem. And I think that's at the heart of what we're talking about in the Sangha. It's an opportunity to drop all of our pretensions. We're not here, you know, even your imbalances will be known, where you want people to like you. That's something that we have to explore. We're not here for that purpose, to have everybody like us. We're not here to be neurotic. We're here to explore our neuroses. We're here to come back into balance, not be out of balance. And everybody feels that. And everybody is allowed to do that in their individual time and in place. Now there's a final component of the Sangha that is not often spoken about, but I want to talk about it just for a minute. And that is the historical Sangha, and how when we take refuge, we're taking refuge in the history of people, of all individuals who have ever practiced in this tradition. It may feel pretentious to you or woo-woo-y to talk about this, but actually the Native Americans would often ceremonially dance upon their ancestral areas. And when they danced together, they would welcome in the spirits of all of their ancestors throughout the dance. And they felt, not in some hypothetical sense, but in actual living sense, those ancestors joining them in that dance. And I'd just like to suggest that taking refuge in the Sangha brings forth that resonance of everyone who has ever had that intention to see what is true forever in the history of our species. And so when you take refuge in it, you take refuge in something very, very powerful, some force of conviction, of confidence, that individually we may not hold in ourselves. And you do that with the solemnity of knowing that I have joined that lineage. I joined that lineage in full flavor. But you also do that with the Buddha in the Dharma as well. When you're taking refuge in the Buddha, in fact, I have had friends say in really horrific situations. They have where there's nothing they can do. Their backs up are against the wall. They take refuge in the Buddha, and that compels a new alternative. Somehow that opens a new alternative in a seemingly closed situation. And I would suggest that we remember that in times of difficulty for ourselves, where we think our options are limited or closed. Especially in death, where I think you may not know what to do. Your consciousness may not know. But to take refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. That may open a new gateway, a new pathway for the consciousness to move. And in times when you think life is miserable, that you are miserable within life, that there's no redeeming quality to life, you might take refuge in the Dharma. To know that beneath our reactivity, there's something true and profoundly available to us if we're willing to go to that level of inquiry and investigation and see. And so these willingness to take refuge is far exceeds just the verbalization that we give in terms of its appearance. There's a depth to each one of these things that can move us very far into our own depth. So that I salute you tonight.